The history of Rocky Horror is a history of cinema.
For everything you like about Rocky Horror, there was at least one film that inspired it.
And we're going to review them all on Episode Zero. Everybody, and welcome back to Episode Zero, the Rocky Horror Picture Show podcast, where we don't really talk about the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Don't we?
My name is William DeBiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic and a longtime Rocky Horror aficionado.
Yeah!
I've seen it a bunch.
You projected it a bunch.
I projected it even more.
How many times did you say you have the Rocky Horror Picture Show, of course, is a cult midnight movie musical. It's been running, pandemic aside, more or less straight every weekend since the 1970s. How many times would you say you projected the Rocky Horror Picture Show?
Gosh.
If you were to guesstimate.
I was working at the New Art Theater here in Los Angeles for nearly 13 years. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't projecting that whole time, though. So
it's
maybe only like the last... maybe like 9 or 10 years that I was projecting.
And did you project Rocky Horror every weekend?
Yeah, I typically worked the Rocky shift every week.
So you probably projected Rocky somewhere between 400 and 450 times.
Yeah, if I did it like every week for 9 years, that would be...
Yeah, it's about 52 weeks a year.
468 weeks.
Yeah, give or take. Yeah. You said you didn't do it necessarily every night, but yeah. Mm. So you know Rocky pretty well.
I've seen it, I've heard it, been around it here and there. It's a big part of my life, actually.
What's your favorite real change in Rocky Horror?
Oh, God.
If you had to pick. Which one really just makes you happy?
It's right in the middle. The one real change, actually, because we started it on 35mm, but we had two uprights that could hold 6K projector reels. That means we could build up the whole film onto just two giant reels and only have one reel change in the middle.
Yeah.
And the reel change in the middle that we always did was right in the middle, right after Frank had killed Eddie.
Mm.
And there's like the trail of blood leading into the freezer, and he says, "One from the vaults," and he takes off his gloves, and we hear Rocky, who is just locked in an elevator, like banging on the bars of this barred elevator. And Frank says, "Oh, baby," and the reel change is right after he says, "Oh, baby."
Okay. So if you're ever watching Rocky Horror and you hear Frank go, "Oh, baby," know that there's, like, someone in the projection booth going, "Oh, shit."
Well, if they haven't started the next projector yet, you're going to see a couple seconds of black, and they fucked up. But after a while, they switched over to digital. We got a digital print over from Fox before it was bought out by Disney, and... there were no real changes after that. It just ran straight through. And the audio was different, which was a little weird.
How so?
There were a few lines and a few vocals in songs that were alternate takes. When they cleared it up, I guess they had to like sort of use alternate vocal tracks to clean it up. And we got the cleaned up digital version.
It
was an alternate version. And everybody who had seen this film hundreds of times were completely thrown off guard.
Oh.
Because they spot those changes immediately.
Does it affect anything?
Or? Well, it's different. I mean, you're used to it one way.
I recently watched, we'll get to the podcast. Mm. I recently watched Oklahoma.
Okay.
And I'd never seen the movie version of Oklahoma before. And so I was really excited about it. And then I'm watching it, and it's a movie from like 1954.
54, I think, yeah.
I'm watching it, and it looks weird. And I'm having trouble figuring out why it looks weird.
Mm.
And then I realize this is not at 24 frames per second. This is at 30.
It was like that motion smoothing thing?
No. They shot it at 30 frames per second.
Okay.
But what they did was they had a special like gimmick screening. It was like going to be the new 3D. We're going to shoot films at 30 frames per second. Mm. It was called, I think, Todd AO. And I don't know what AO stood for.
Yeah, Todd AO.
So they filmed it briefly in like certain theaters.
Mm.
They screened it in the 30 frames per second. But they actually filmed a 24 frames per second version with the same actors, but it's different takes.
Yeah, yeah.
And apparently, amongst Oklahoma aficionados, I've only seen the Tadeo version. Amongst Oklahoma aficionados, the Tadeo version is considered, like, better. Like, just everyone was kind of on their shit that day. Like, they would do the Tadeo version first, and after everyone was tired, they'd do the 24 frames per second version. So the 24 frames per second version, though good, is considered the lesser of the two by many. Huh. So when you watch it on, like, Amazon Prime, they only have the Tadeo version. So well, it right. looks weird. It looks like you're watching a BBC show, but... Because the BBC is shot in, used to be shot in PAL, which used more frames per second than 24.
I think
it's 29 point something, actually.
Oh, I thought it was 32. Oh, no, Beta's 32.
No, PAL is a digital format, and it was 29 point something.
Okay.
And if you'll notice if you watch like old BBC shows, everything just looks like it's moving a little too fast. And it takes your eye a few minutes to adjust. Yeah, that's what Oklahoma was like. It has nothing to do with Rocky Horror. But it was alternate versions of the film, so I guess that's where we're going from. Mm-hmm. This is a Rocky Horror podcast. We usually don't dilly-dally this much at the front. The idea behind this podcast is that Rocky Horror, much like a lot of pop culture phenomenon, Rocky Horror is based on a lot of films.
we're delving into the prehistory of an important pop culture phenomenon.
Yeah, it didn't come from out of nowhere. It had a lot of films that preceded it, that influenced it directly or indirectly. Rocky Horror, in particular, is very clear about calling most of its shots. Mm. It will explicitly reference many films. And I think this is actually one of them. This we're going to be talking about in this episode, two iconic adventure movies from the early 1930s, pre-code, very sexy. These are Tarzan the Ape Man and, in a special double feature, Tarzan and his mate.
Tarzan, what am I doing here, alone with you? Perhaps I better not think too much about that. Not a bit afraid, not a bit sorry.
Yeah.
These were the only two that were made before the implementation of the Hays Code.
Yeah.
When you get to the third film, which is called Tarzan Escapes, fully in oh, excuse me, dropping things. It's in full force, full swing. That's Hays Code.
It gets a lot less sexy.
There's a lot less skin. There's a lot less talk of sex and sexuality. There's a lot less violence.
I remember when I was young.
And they're not as good.
No, that's true. I remember when I was young, I'd been reading about, I was reading about classic movies. Like, oh, where do I start? What do I watch? And I read a review of Tarzan and His Mate. And they referred to Margaret O'Sullivan? Marina Sullivan. There's Margaret Sullivan, who was in Shop Around the Corner.
Yeah.
Then there's Maureen O'Sullivan, and there's Maureen O'Hara. There's too many. Anyway, no.
Maureen O'Sullivan played Jane in these movies.
They referred to her outfit in Tarzan and His Mate specifically as Madonna would blush. And I remember thinking to myself, no, that's ridiculous. And then I watched the movie, I'm like, wow, that is skimpy.
Yeah, yeah.
That does not leave much to the imagination. Holy cow.
You're dressed like an Instagram influencer bikini model.
It's very, 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 very fleshy. These two movies.
And that second movie, there's even a nude swimming scene where she's just naked.
I think it's a body double, actually. It's a body double. But yeah,
Someone is naked on screen in a film from the 1930s, which, you know... Yeah.
For a while. They're doing like, aquatic ballet.
Yeah. There's a tendency, especially among people our age who got to see a lot of entertainment from the 1950s, that the past was a more chaste time.
Mm.
And you can start to make the incorrect assumption that the further back you go, the more chaste it would be. Mm. No, we were filthy all along.
Yeah.
And the filth was always out there. Whether or not it was out in the open is the only difference.
We invented cameras. We immediately started thinking about what naughty things we can put in front of them.
Yeah, I think a horse running was the first thing photographed. A nude woman was the second. The technology was used for prurient things right from the start. And Tarzan, these two Tarzan movies, we're bringing up the Prairians because I think that's kind of its primary influence on a lot of cinema that was to come after.
Yeah, certainly on Rocky.
On Rocky. And the fact that sex and sexuality, particularly female sexuality, is presented as a very bold and empowering thing.
Yeah,
these first two movies.
The first two Tarzan movies, to be clear, there were actually silent movies about Tarzan. Tarzan was a very popular literary creation.
We say first two, but these are not the first two films to feature Tarzan.
No. Edgar Rice Burroughs. Edgar Rice Burroughs created Tarzan. He also created John Carter of Mars. Tarzan was a big hit. It was a massive sensation. There were silent movies that preceded it. Some of them are famous people. Boris Karloff was the bad guy in one of them.
The city of Tarzana, California was named after Tarzan because Edgar Rice Burroughs lived there.
Exactly. So the silent era comes to a really abrupt end. Like, once they start making sound movies, everyone's like, oh, no. And like, there's like a year and a half, maybe two, where they're phasing out silent theaters, and some movies are made silent versions and sound versions. But by the early 30s, sound was functionally dead. And exact opposite of what I meant. Silent movies were functionally dead. So a lot of these things were getting remade and rebooted. Tarzan was one of them, and this was going to be a major production right from the start. What's interesting about it is that, well, there's a lot of interesting things about this movie for its many things that it does well and for the many things that it's really unfortunately a part of. But Tarzan is considered like one of the classic movie adventures of the 1930s. Like, it's right up there with The Adventures of Robin Hood or Captain Blood. But it actually wasn't the film that popularized the genre that it's in, this colonialist adventure genre. Mm-hmm. In fact, the movie that was, and this had always been like a hit maker for Hollywood, but the movie that became like the sort of lightning rod for this genre and led to a whole bunch of copycats is a much shittier movie.
Which was nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards.
Yeah, it's called Traitor Horn. Not only is Traitor Horn a badly told story, not only is it phenomenally racist, and we're going to talk about how Tarzan is racist too, but compared to Traitor Horn, Traitor Horn is just disgustingly racist. Yeah.
Traitor Horn is just... it's not just dealing with racist tropes. Like, it has openly racist characters saying racist things.
Yeah, and treated as the heroes as the result. It's really gross to watch. It's also a safari film in which they actually filmed a lot of real wildlife footage. They filmed the death of animals.
Get to see animals dying on camera.
Allegedly, one of the people working on the film died on camera making it, and they kept it in the film. Like, it's a fucked up movie.
Yeah, and
it's really hard to watch today for a variety of reasons. A, it's racist. B, it's really exploitative and shitty. And C, it sucks.
It's not good. That's you shouldn't watch it for any of those reasons. Yeah. It's like, it's not one of those films that a lot of people like to describe as problematic, which just means, you know, a well-made movie and a well-told story, but blisteringly racist.
Yeah, or sexist. In poor taste, problems. But perhaps there may be a quality that people like to say, like, well, at least this part's good. Yeah. You can't say that with Traitor Horn. The best you can say is, like, the footage that they got on location is kind of...
Is it authentic?
Yeah, it's authentic. It's some interesting camera angles in it, but it is not worth seeing this movie for a couple of good camera angles. It sucks. But it was a huge, huge, huge hit. In fact, it was such a huge hit that they thought, we're going to do a sequel to Traitor Horn, and we're going to have Traitor Horn, this, like, you know, guy in a safari hat and a gun who wanders around killing everything and being racist. We're going to have him meet Tarzan in the sequel. Mm. And eventually they decided to drop that whole bit and just do Tarzan. Which is probably a good idea. Mm. However, in the trailer for Tarzan, if you look at the original trailer for Tarzan the Ape Man, like, on the title card, it says Tarzan the Ape Man. And then in parentheses, the Traitor Horn of 1932, or something to that effect. And like, they'll even say, like, more thrilling than Traitor Horn. Like,
you know what?
They knew that people would compare it to this other movie that was bigger at the time and is completely forgotten now.
Trader Horn had a sexed up spoof in the 60s. You can get it through Something Weird Video, and they called it rather predictably Trader Horny.
Yeah. Hey, that writes itself.
Yeah, horny with two E's, so if you want to look it up.
Well, that makes it sound like you should have an accent over one of them. It should be Trader Horny.
Maybe it is Trader Horny. These are all based on, like, H. Rider Haggard is a rather famous author of these kinds of adventure books.
He created Alan Quartermain.
Yeah, Alan Quartermain.
Sean Connery from League of Extraordinary Gentlemen played that
character. And a lot of those books have been adapted to film. Hmm. And they're all based in a fundamentally kind of racist construct. It's the colonialist construct. It's the manifest destiny construct that the white man... Specifically, the Caucasian male has sort of this God-given right to conquer.
Yeah.
And go to all of these places and go into, quote, darkest Africa, which is the phrase they use most
just
often.
Just a terrible
phrase. To explore and take and spread their influence and all this. It was depicted as being a very positive thing.
Yeah, he's going to... These white heroes, Alan Quartermain, Trader Horn, to... only a somewhat different extent, Tarzan, but it's functionally the same thing. They go to this place that isn't where their people are from, and they consider them that they believe that they have the right to take whatever they want, kill whatever they want, condescend to whatever they want, brutalize and kill whoever they want, and that they will be perceived as the heroes for doing so because we're just so damn awesome.
It's
really grotesque, actually.
We're powerful enough to just inflict death around the world. And
some stories try to mitigate that a little bit. I've seen attempts to turn, like, King Solomon's Mines into something that's a little bit... The Stuart Granger version isn't, like, it's probably the best version of that story. And in that version in particular, they try to make it seem like, you know, oh, Alan Quartermain knows that all this stuff is shitty. You're still doing it, Alan. You're still doing it. Like, that doesn't make it okay.
And wouldn't you know it, it still persists in this weird legacy of today. King Kong is most certainly one of these stories.
Absolutely one of those stories.
There's a conversation in my boss's film, Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah.
Where they talk about... The Nazi soldiers and some undercover agents are playing a card game at a table where they have a fictional character... Or a historical figure on a card on their forehead that they can't see, and they have to ask 20 questions.
Yeah.
And the Nazi soldier figures out, he has King Kong written on his head.
But he doesn't know who that is. He has to guess,
and he asks all of these questions. So it's about somebody who is taken from their home in an exotic locale and taken and put on a stage. Yeah. Taken to America, owned by people, and put on a stage for people to sort of gawk at. I know exactly what this is. This is the black man's experience in America.
Uh-huh.
And they say, no, that's not right. Oh, then I'm King Kong.
Yeah,
that's the way that scene plays out.
And of course, the joke is that is right. That's what King Kong is about.
That was the King Kong story. It is a fundamentally racist construct.
I haven't seen the new Godzilla versus Kong yet, but I think it's fascinating that we have these two monsters, one of whom, Godzilla, represents the destructive power of America, and King Kong, who represents someone who has actually been wronged by America.
I'm wondering if any of that will come into play.
I hope it does.
Because in the previous... the most recent American Godzilla films, they haven't addressed it at all.
No, in fact, they really ran away from the idea that Kong represented anything bad about America. And I didn't dislike King of the Monsters. I thought it had some fun monster fight in action, but...
It's fine.
And whatever. My point is this. The part of the movie that made me wince was when a Japanese character... had to save the world by feeding Godzilla, a metaphor for the nuclear devastation of Japan, feeding Godzilla nuclear bombs. Mm. And I'm watching this and I'm like, did you think this out at all?
I kind of forgot what this was all about.
Seriously, Godzilla is a very potent metaphor for the destructive power of nuclear bombs, and specifically America. Holy fuck, people.
This idea of adventure is all based in these colonialist and racist constructs.
And
Tarzan comes from that.
And that persists in other stories as well. I mean, Avatar... is very much about that. It's about, one guy, like, all of these colonialist jerks come to this planet, they're gonna destroy it, they're gonna rip the resources out of the land, and then one guy ends up, like, becoming greater, a better version of the local people than anyone else, which is a fundamentally racist premise.
I don't know what story it was that popularized the white man goes native narrative, but that's the story in Avatar.
Yeah.
A lot of people compared it to Dances with Wolves. Dances with Wolves was just another repetition of that narrative. Yeah.
Well, I think Tarzan is the fundamental part of it. I don't know if it's the original, but it's a fundamental part of it. The idea of Tarzan as a creation is if you ever read the novel, they don't really go into it in the movie. His parents were in a plane crash or a ship crash. I forget which one it is.
I think it depends on which Tarzan you're
I'm trying to remember
at.
When the book was published, if the planes had actually been like invented yet. But anyway.
I think in this movie anyway, I think he's just abandoned.
Yeah, well, that's the idea. It's like his parents died. He was stranded in the jungle. And I believe the idea was there was a plane crash and he was stranded. And he ended up being raised by gorillas. Okay. And he was raised to be, and he was the only white person in the entire region. And by virtue of his inherent awesomeness, he ends up becoming the alpha predator.
Well, it's
of the region. Mm-hmm. And there's something inherently like, oh, so this fundamental premise of the story is that when a white guy is raised in this environment, they instantly become the best of that region. And that's something kind of fucked up about that.
If you want to be generous, you could just say it's by dint of his human intelligence, and he is ruling over animals.
But he's not the only human in the region. He's the only one who can talk to animals and shit. He's the only one who can, like, he's stronger than everybody. He's more capable than everybody. He's more moral than everybody. He represents, it's almost, in some respects, you could argue it's even worse than something like Trader Horn, where it's people who actually come to this place fully formed with their full ideas. He actually comes to this position sort of by virtue of birthright, fate. By birthright. Yeah. Exactly. They call him King of the Jungle.
In the movies, he's played by Olympic swimmer Johnny Weissmuller.
Yeah.
Not much of an actor, that Johnny Weissmuller, but got a good physique.
He's got a good physique. I think he does a pretty good job with Tarzan. Tarzan is a character who, you know, you don't have to deliver a lot of lines.
Yeah.
And I think it's mostly physicality, and I think he plays it. I think he throws himself into it really well. There's a sort of childlike nature to the way he behaves. Apparently, that one of the original like people they were thinking of casting for Tarzan was Clark Gable, but he wasn't a big enough star yet, which is hilarious. And apparently, based on what I read, I don't know how true this is, Johnny Weissmuller got the part because he was visiting his friend Clark Gable at the studio, and he ended up getting the role.
Johnny Weissmuller, big man about town, was a well-established figure in Hollywood and before and after Tarzan.
Yeah, there were a lot of roles for like burly, muscly men, and you got him and Buster Crabbe, and they were just in a ton of different.
I think Buster Crabbe played Johnny Weissmuller played Tarzan in 12 feature films over the course of 8 years.
Yeah, big hits,
and they were all big hits, and then I think Buster Crabbe took over for him after. But yeah, he was a man about town. He was a well-known celebrity. I got to swim in a pool he designed.
No shit. What made it interesting that he designed it? Was it just like, it can't just be square?
It was just square. It had a certain kind of gravel. Like it was a rough edges I guess in a way he liked.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, at the Lafayette Hotel in San Diego, California, which is where all the celebrities used to stay.
That's cool.
And like swimmers would go there to train to swim the English Channel, like it was in the Johnny Weissmuller pool.
That's cool.
Johnny Weissmuller plays Tarzan. The first third of the first Tarzan movie is
Tarzan doesn't show up for the longest time in the first one. It's like, Jane's story for the most.
It's like 38 minutes. Well, and even after we meet Tarzan, it's still Jane's story. In fact, the first two movies are Jane's story.
They really are, and I actually really like that about him. Mm-hmm. So the idea is Jane is a British socialite. Who has come to Africa to visit her father, who is in the midst of a lot of trading deals. Mm. And he has come into information about where there is a secret elephant burial ground. Mm. And the idea is that when elephants know they're going to die, they all decide to go into the same place. And their idea is, instead of risking everything to try to like kill an elephant and take its ivory, there's going to be like centuries worth of ivory just sitting there. We can just take it home with us. And while, yes, that is, a burial ground, it is also probably better for the elephants. One could make the argument than just killing all the new ones.
Fair.
Yeah.
Fair. I mean, I'd rather that a poacher take ivory from dead elephants.
Yeah, from hundreds of years of dead elephants.
Then that is, kill that an
is,
elephant.
That is better. One is less evil than the other. Neither of them are good.
Yeah, that we value ivory at all is kind of sick, but there
yes,
you go.
Yes, it is. So
his hat is ivory? His boots are ivory? I think his check is ivory.
Listen, Whitney, a person who has a lot of ivory is less likely to want more ivory than someone whose ivory stockpile is low. From The Simpsons. Anyway, so they're gonna go into this like uncharted region of Africa in order to find this elephant burial ground. Jane decides to go with her father, and
it's not all that uncharted because people live there.
Well, that's true. They haven't charted it. The white people haven't charted it. It's a good point.
It's like in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Deep space? They're right next to Bajor. That's gotta make Bajorans feel pretty shitty. You're way out in deep space. It's not deep space. We live here.
Never actually thought about it.
We are occupied by another race. There's a lot of traffic.
Also, there is, in addition to Jane's father, there is a handsome young man who is a competitor for Jane's affections, and he's played by Neil Hamilton, the commissioner from the 1960s Batman TV series.
And he looks like Commissioner Gordon. Commissioner Gordon.
He looks exactly like you would imagine he would look 30 years earlier. He's good. He got nothing against him. It's just a little distracting because I know him so well from the 1960s Batman.
What a career that guy.
I know, right? So they travel into the jungle and it takes a long time. People die. There's some really cool mat shots where they're like climbing along cliffs. They look like they're like thousands of feet up in the air when they clearly weren't, but like it still looks cool.
Oh yeah.
It's impressive production, certainly. And then they run into this Tarzan dude, and Tarzan abruptly kidnaps Jane. And Jane is like trying to fight him off. Like, who are you? You weird creep. And then she realizes that he's not going to like attack her. He realizes that she realizes he's actually kind of childish, and she starts really like having fun. Like
it instantly has the upper hand here.
Yeah,
and realizes this is great.
Yeah,
everything is safe here. The animals don't attack.
Yeah, this guy is going to protect me.
This childish dunderhead who's built like Johnny Weissmuller. And he is my plaything. And all of a sudden, she is... Like, Tarzan is called the ape man.
Yeah.
The king of the jungle. As soon as she is in Tarzan's company, she becomes queen of the jungle.
She's in charge of everything.
Everything.
Like, she's in charge of Tarzan's heart. And she enjoys it. This is a fantasy about
having... So much
having
agency, yeah.
The Rocky from Rocky Horror, the, like, Frankenstein monster that Frankenfurter creates who looks just like Johnny Weissmuller... that's the fantasy. He's the absolute, you know, absolute physical pinnacle of a man, but I have all the power. And the movie relishes in that. The movie knows that this is the fantasy, that women are going to watch this, or men are going to watch this, and they're going to see this relationship, which is not the typical action hero relationship, and go... Well, that sounds just fun.
It's not bad for me.
Yeah. So it's kink. It's a lot of kink.
And that's even rolled with when you fast forward to something like George of the Jungle.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the slapstick version of Tarzan.
And, that movie still holds up. That movie's funny.
That 97 George of the Jungle movie with
Brendan
Fraser.
They know just how stupid that is. They're having fun in that movie.
And Leslie Mann plays the Jane character in that one. Ursula is the character's name.
Yeah.
And... she ends up, you know, living with George of the Jungle for a little bit, and she's just like, oh, and I get to eat mangoes, and let's go talk to the Tuki Tuki bird, and she's just having a grand old time.
Yeah. And who's the jerk boyfriend in that? Is it Thomas Hayden Church?
Thomas Hayden Church.
Thomas Hayden Church comes in and ruins everything, because of course he does. He actually even looks a little bit like Neil Hamilton, which is kind of funny. I never really thought of it. They have, like, the same square jaw.
Squint a little bit, I suppose.
They can be related. Jane's father and Neil Hamilton find her, and they immediately assume that she's in danger. So they start shooting at the apes, and they kill one of Tarzan's ape friends. And Tarzan, who had never seen a gun before, is very confused, and then fucking furious. And then
he becomes an agent of death.
He actually becomes like, he's a serial killer for a solid 10 minutes of this movie, where
just
they're like,
people
they get
off in a camp.
They
yeah,
grab
awesome.
Jane, and then they're like, okay, everyone, let's just get away from the weird jungle, dude.
Let's just camp here where he'll never find
he's
us.
Just picking them off one by one. He's silhouetted against the distance like a fucking villain. Like, it's kind of cool, actually. Yeah. And then everyone except Tarzan gets kidnapped by a bunch of dudes in blackface.
It's the tribe of pygmies. Yeah,
yeah, and a bunch of little people in blackface.
Little people, it sucks. There are actors of color, but yeah, then there's also standing right next to them are Caucasian actors who've been painted.
That part sucks. And of course these people are othered like crazy, and they're treated as these just monstrous villains, and people are thrown into a pit. Like, basically the inspiration for the Rancor pit in Jabba's palace.
A lot of Star Wars. Just a lot of adventure stories. Star Wars. A little bit more so Indiana Jones, but the kinds of things that people our age grew up watching are directly influenced by Tarzan and the Tarzan movies and other adventure serials that were like cheap knockoffs of Tarzan.
Mm. Yeah, and we already talked about some of these when we did Star Wars Episode Zero. Yeah.
Did you ever see the Errol Morris film Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control?
No, I didn't see that one.
Yeah, the binding material for that film. It's this rather bizarre documentary about four experts who are experts in really weird things. There's a robotics expert, a guy who's an expert in naked mole rats, a topiary gardener. And Errol Morris just declares that these people are just all geniuses, and genius just looks... That takes many forms. Mm. But the binding material was an old serial called Darkest Africa, which was this unabashed Tarzan ripoff. But in that one, it's like they reuse like... For the African characters, it's just white guys, but they put on like Hawkman costumes that was clearly left over from some sci-fi serial.
Probably Flash Gordon.
Yeah, probably Flash Gordon serial. When you see those, you can see actually how deeply Tarzan penetrated, like right away, how the Tarzan fantasy became just sort of standard.
Yeah. One of the gorillas actually like runs to get Tarzan, and there's this extended sequence where I think it's a chimpanzee, isn't it?
It's cheetah.
Yeah, cheetah actually like runs across the jungle, has to fight off lion and stuff.
Not a cheetah. Cheetah is the name of the chimpanzee.
Yeah, sorry. Thank you for clarifying. Yeah, that's Tarzan's best pal, is Jimmy Olsen, if you will. But cheetah runs everywhere, and there's this whole extended sequence. It's basically like a silent movie where cheetah is like, racing across the jungle trying to find Tarzan. They find Tarzan, Tarzan summons with his iconic Tarzan yell, which really is nothing like that sound. That sound is whoever came up with that sound knew how to make an iconic sound.
Right next to the Godzilla roar, there's just one of the great pieces of sound design in cinema history.
There's a lot. Unfortunately, we'll probably never know for sure who actually came up with and did that yell. Some have argued that Johnny Weissmuller did it themselves. Some argued that they came up with it in post. I think
Johnny Weissmuller did not do that himself.
I'm just saying a lot of people want credit for it. Who knows who actually did it anymore? It's actually a little unclear. He summons a whole herd of elephants to destroy the village and save everybody. I'm not 100% on this, but if I were to guess, I wonder if they reuse some footage from this movie Chang from the late 1920s. One of the first film at the first Academy Awards, there were actually two Academy Awards for Best Picture, and they were considered equal. There was Outstanding Production, which was basically the best mainstream movie, and that's the award that the movie Wings won. Wings is typically considered the first Best Picture winner. However, there were two Best Picture winners that year, and the other one was for most unique and artistic production.
Yeah, it's like best art film, essentially. Yeah.
That was won by F.W. Murnau's Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans, and deservedly so. That movie kicks ass. But one of the other nominees, and it's the only documentary or quasi-documentary ever nominated for Best Picture, is a movie called Chang, which is basically another one of these motion pictures. And it's all about like people living in the wilds and hunting animals and killing them on camera, which is really fucked up. But there actually is this very staged bit where they got a bunch of elephants to come in and like rampage through a village. Mm-hmm. And it looks similar. I'm sure it was influenced by it. I don't know if it's actually the same footage, but it looks similar.
It's actually, elephants play a larger role than apes in Tarzan the Ape Man.
Yeah, oh, sorry, I bumped the microphone. But yeah, they do. They're the plot.
In fact, wasn't that plot point repeated in that really rotten Tarzan film from just a couple of years ago? With Christoph Waltz and Alexander Skarsgård, the one that was made by David Yates.
I couldn't remember the plots of that movie. Put a gun to my head. All I remember is that it was a sequel. It took place after Tarzan had moved back to London, and him and Jane had to go back home.
For some reason.
And that it's basically we skipped Crocodile Dundee and we moved right to Crocodile Dundee 2. Like, that was the premise of that movie, and I remember nothing else about it other than the big stampede at the end, which was admittedly kind of cool. Yeah. Like, that's it. Everything else about that movie is vapor to me. Like, I know the cast, but that's it.
There's only one detail that stuck with me from that film, where Christoph Waltz is the bad guy and he's captured the young heroine.
Christoph Waltz is the bad guy?
Yeah, wouldn't you know it?
What? What is this nonsense?
Should have cast him to play Tarzan with a really nice haircut. there's a bit where he's forcing his kidnapping victim to... I think it was Margot Robbie in that movie.
Margot Robbie. Jane, it's a good cast.
It's a good cast. And that's a good schmodown question.
There you go.
But he's forcing her to have dinner. It's like, you have to dress nice and have dinner with me in my chambers. And,
yeah, I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark. I'm doing it again. Ha! Try to stop me.
Yeah, but shameless knockoff. And the detail I remember is he's like, now you're my prisoner, but thank you for being civilized with me. And she says, screw you, I'm out of here. And she storms out of the room. And he reaches across her plate and arranges her dishes before he continues eating.
Yeah.
And that was something that was actually taught me as a kid, that when you're still eating and you want to put your cutlery down, you put them down in sort of an inverted V shape so you could like grab them again. But if you're done, you arrange them both off to one side. So the waiter presumably knows you're finished.
Yeah. So he put them in a V shape because she's coming back.
They were in a V shape and he knew she left. So he reached over and he put them off to the side.
Oh, that's cute.
That was like one cute detail. That's all I remember from that stupid ass Tarzan movie was the cutlery scene.
That's one of my favorite things, is like a movie where you remember one specific thing in a lot of detail, but the rest of the movie is gone.
Yeah.
it's one of those things where it's like, now that I'm thinking about it, I can't think of an example, but I know there's a million of those. Anyway, Tarzan saves them. One of the elephants is injured in the big giant climax, and they realize that the elephant is dying, and so they follow the elephant to the elephant graveyard. But unfortunately, Jane's dad also, unfortunately in air quotes, Jane's dad also dies, and they bury him in the elephant graveyard. And Neil Hamilton says, hey, well, this didn't go well, and like all the people we had to bring back the ivory are dead, so I'm just going to go home. And Jane's like, cool, you do that. And he's like, you're going to come with? Fuck no.
I have
a Tarzan. I'm good, thank you. And so he's like, I really can't compete with that at all. Okay, I'll come back for the ivory someday. You're cool with that, right? And Jane's like, yeah, we haven't thought out the sequel yet. Cool. And then the sequel came along, and we didn't really think that plot point out because it's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, Neil Hamilton is back as the same character, and he...
2 years later, Tarzan and his mate.
I think it was made 2 years later, but I think it takes place 5 years later, so...
No, I don't think it's that long. No, it's not that long.
It's not that long?
Okay, no, it's a couple of years, but it's not... I don't think it's two, but you're right.
But yeah, Jane has been living in complete bliss with Tarzan, and it's in this film... the first film was directed by W.S. Van Dyke.
Who directed a lot of stuff.
Just a hardworking director. The sequel was directed by Cedric Gibbons, who is one of the single most Academy Awarded filmmakers in history.
Yeah. For directing, though.
For art direction. He was nominated, I think, 39 times for 39 different films, won 11 times.
That's really quite a lot.
And he designed the statuette that he got a lot of.
Yeah, he designed the Oscar. That's fucking cool.
That's an interesting piece of trivia right there. Yeah. Cedric Gibbons is his name.
Cedric Gibbons won Academy Awards. He won for a lot, but he won Academy Awards for the 1940 Pride and Prejudice, the 1944 classic Gaslight, The Yearling, the 1949 The Little Women, The Bad and the Beautiful, the Marlon Brando version of Julius Caesar. He was also nominated for films like Romeo and Juliet, The Wizard of Oz, which, thinking back, like, how did The Wizard of Oz lose that Oscar? Random Harvest, The Picture of Dorian Gray, National Velvet, Brigadoon. You're like, holy fuck. Like, what a career this guy had. And also, he directed.
And he had a famous family. His niece married Gary Cooper, and his son is in ZZ Top.
No shit! That's weird.
Billy Gibbons is this guy's son.
That's so very weird. What an interesting person and family.
Yeah, interesting guy. A lot.
My parents were teachers. I mean, that's nice and all, but how many Oscars did we get?
I'm not related to anybody in ZZ Top. Well, what have I done? Yeah, this one really rolls with the idea.
Oh my god, this
that,
is the only movie he ever directed.
Yeah, it's his only directing effort, and it's great.
Oh my god, it's I mean, again, it's colonialist at its core, but as a movie, it's very well made. It's kind of weird that he didn't make more.
Yeah, this one was
it was a hit. Like, I don't
really well put together, and this one really rolls with, I think, more so than Tarzan the Ape Man. The idea that Tarzan is, we talked about how it's this colonialist fantasy, but it's also a sex fantasy.
Yeah.
H. Rider Haggard, the whole her, Sheena, that sort of thing. Those are also sex fantasies.
But those are male sex.
Those are male sex fantasies about man finding scantily clad women in the woods, and it's essentially just about seeing flesh and having sex in the jungle. Tarzan is that for women.
Yeah.
These are Jane's movies, and in this movie, Jane is openly living out her ultimate sex fantasy.
Yeah.
Living in the jungle, nearly naked, with a nearly naked dude.
Yeah. Sleeping who worships her.
Worships her, brings her fruit. They get to sleep in these warm mosses. Yeah.
Her entire day is just lounging around, being waited on hand and foot by the hunkiest man in the world who fights animals to the death for her. Like, it's a power fantasy.
Yeah, and clearly they have access to soap, makeup, and razors, because Tarzan never has a beard in any story of Tarzan, which I find a little unusual. But Johnny Weissmuller additionally has a cleanly shaved chest and armpits.
Yeah. Whatever, it's a fantasy. We're all just enjoying it. So the
a big portion of this movie, or at least a lot of what I took away from Tarzan and his mate, was that it's just great to live with Tarzan.
I mean, that's kind of the plot too. So the plot of this one, Neil Hamilton is back, and he has returned. He is a new investor, spent all of his money, like his last dollar. It's an important plot point. He spent all of his money on this expedition to pick up all the ivory because Neil Hamilton knows where it is.
Mm.
Neil Hamilton, like an idiot, like leaves the map with like the big X marks the spot bit like out in the open, and a bunch of people get a head start on him. So they are racing to get to this ivory. And in also his ulterior motive is he's brought a lot of frilly things. He's brought, you know, silk dresses and perfumes and makeup.
Trying to lure Jane out of the jungle.
Like, hey, she's been in the jungle for a while. I love that not for one second does he wonder if she's dead. Because anything can happen. She could fall out of a tree and, like, you know, something gets infected. She could be dead. He assumes she's alive. He's right. But I think it's funny that it doesn't even occur to him to think about it. So I'm going to find Jane while I'm there. And I'm going to, she's been living in you know, the jungle for a year or two. And she might miss London. And if she does, that's where I can swoop in and be her silver medal. So... that's the plan.
Look, if your gold medal is Tarzan,
everyone's a silver medal.
Just let it go.
Yeah. If you're gonna settle for me.
I forgot who said it about the movie. He's just not that into you. The movie.
Oh yeah.
Where one of the plots in that movie is a husband maybe having an affair with Scarlett Johansson, and I remember some critics said, "You just let that go."
It's a very dude thing to say.
It was a dude critic, but yeah, it's like, just let your husband have an affair with Scarlett
Johansson. That's how I would be if it was just like, hey, I'm trying to think of who's the super hunk du jour right now. If Pedro Pascal like made the moves on you, I'd be like, hey, go for it.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, if he was making the moves on me, I'd go like, go for it.
I know a lot of couples like to have like, what celebrities are on your like your safe list? Like fidelity, please, but if we're gonna cheat.
Yeah.
If this opportunity arises,
I wouldn't stand in
your way. And usually the list is like one celebrity or five celebrities. And my wife and I came to the conclusion, it's like, you know what? any celebrities. It's not like it's ever going to happen.
Like, oh my God.
If it's really rare, it's like, I'm in a hot tub with Ben Affleck.
He's number six on the list.
It's like he's not on my list, but it's like, Ben Affleck. I would not begrudge you Ben Affleck, all right?
Anyway, Neil Hamilton wants to lure Jane back. And Jane, you know, she actually does like feminine things. Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, a dress. I haven't put on a dress and stockings in a while. Oh, these are nice. Oh, that perfume smells nice. Mm-hmm. And Tarzan's like, comes in and is like, and he's talking more now, but he's not like articulate. Mm-hmm. And he's just basically comes in and he's like, the fuck is this shit? And Jane's just like, oh, it's girl stuff. And he's like, no. Like, better when you're naked. And she's like, well, I did too, but... And so,
we live in the jungle. The weather's constant. We sleep under weeds. We just swim. There's...
Yeah.
Fruit is plentiful. Animals help us and like us.
Yeah.
What do we need clothes for?
Even... Tarzan basically asks her, like, why? Why are you wearing a dress? And her argument is, well, women wear these things because they think men will like them. And Tarzan's like, I already like you.
Yeah.
And, like... And, of course, that's... also kind of a sexist perspective because she can wear whatever the fuck she wants. She has agency, and indeed she does. But it's it basically calls attention to the fact that she doesn't actually need anything Neil Hamilton is offering her.
It's comfortingly pragmatic.
Yeah, so Neil Hamilton is offering her things that ultimately are nice, but she makes a choice and she chooses Tarzan pretty easily. Tarzan had agreed long ago to bring Neil Hamilton back to the elephant burial ground. Mm. And Tarzan's like, okay, here you go. Here's your elephant burial ground. Enjoy. And they're like, okay, great. We're just going to load up all this ivory. And Tarzan's like, you never said anything about taking ivory back. And they're like, well, what did you think we were here for? He's like, I don't fucking know. You guys are weird. you guys do all kinds of weird shit. You shot my friend? Like, I thought it was pretty cool about that. I only killed, like, three of you. Like, I took you to your fucking elephant burial ground. Enjoy your sightseeing tour, then get the fuck out. And they're like, no, we were going to desecrate all of these corpses of your friends. And he's like, yeah, you're not fucking doing that.
I really wish he just talked, like, really straightforward.
Like, you actually translate what Tarzan means. It's actually kind of funny.
Hey, here's the burial ground. Yeah, thanks. No, fuck you.
Yeah, I can't do that shit. What the fuck you?
Why are you taking bones, you fucking weirdo?
The investor who Neil Hamilton brought onto this thing, and who's very desperate, there's a bit at the beginning of the movie where they're headed towards the region where Tarzan lives, and it's considered, like, kind of cursed. And, like, some of the people in their expedition don't want to go. Mm. He just kills one of them. And Neil Hamilton is like, hey, don't overdo it. And he's like, no, you just killed a guy. He's a person, you fuck. Like, you just killed a guy. And then later on, when Tarzan won't show them where the elephant burial ground is, he's like, oh, okay. This elephant friend of yours? Bang! Shoots the elephant and says, well, just follow that elephant. Fuck you, dude. That's some fucked up shit. Yeah. So they're going to take back the ivory.
Logically, right?
Yeah. And they scheme to get rid of Tarzan. Tarzan is actually incapacitated. And he fights animal after animal in this thing. So he fights like a giant alligator in this one, or crocodile. I can never tell the difference. I think it's a crocodile, right? It's a crocodile. Yeah. Alligators are like southern United States, right?
Yeah.
Okay, it's a crocodile. Big old crocodile. And if I got that wrong, fine. I'm going to let it go. He fights off all these animals, sometimes more convincingly than others, and it all boils down to, oh, good, so we've got all this ivory, and Jane is convinced that Tarzan is done for, she's just going to come back with us, and we'll settle for that. Hmm. And then they get surrounded by, like, hundreds of lions. Like, there's another, like, group of people living in that area, and they summon all these lions to kill all these dudes. And I'm like, fine. Go get them. These guys are assholes. And Tarzan has to come in, save the day, fight the lions. Tarzan does. And Jane stays with Tarzan. Because she's cool. She's fine with this. This is what she wants.
What I've always loved about the Tarzan movie, and I've seen the first 12 Tarzan movies. It's been a while, but I watched them. Like
those are all with Johnny Weissmuller, although Marino O'Sullivan wasn't involved.
Marino O'Sullivan left after, I think, the... fifth? Maybe I'd have to look it up again.
She's not the whole time. Yeah, no, they replaced her.
And Tarzan and Jane did find a son at one point. They didn't have a son.
Yeah, because it's after the production code, and Tarzan and Jane never got married. So that means they've never had sex. That's what Tarzan Finds His Son is about. They've never had sex. They will never have sex because they're living out of wedlock. So in order to have a child, they had to find one.
Tarzan and his mate is like a hair away from being porn, for God's sake. Like, it's...
Yeah. And not long hair either. Yeah. Very short hair away from being porn. Like, it's very naughty.
It's pretty explicit that this is a sex fantasy. Mm-hmm. It's Jane's sex fantasy. It is a sex fantasy for the women in the audience, or some of the men in the audience, yeah, I imagine, too. But it's Jane is the character we're meant to sort of project ourselves into, and having this big dunderhead as our essentially our sex companion.
Yeah.
That's the appeal of these movies. At least these first two movies.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people understood this about Tarzan. And that's definitely the subtext that was being unlocked when we came to Rocky.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That is Rocky Horror, the character, as well as the film. Having this hunky dunderhead at your beck and call.
Well, I mean, like Frankenfurter says, I didn't make him for you. Frankenfurter realized his ideal sexual specimen, which is someone who is incredibly sexy, the prototypical masculine ideal, full of really, you know, carved into marble muscles, but also someone who, you know, won't try to engage you in conversation, you know?
Oh, let me look up the lyrics to Julie Brown's hit song, I Like 'Em Big and Stupid. She actually uses the Tarzan yell during the chorus of that one, but it's... you know what kind of guy does a lot for me? Superman with a lobotomy. Like, she thanks, just really. wants a big, dumb, hunky guy.
Yeah. Like, that was a comedy song.
My brother's out of Harvard. My father's out of Yale. But the guy I brought home last night just got out of jail. That was one of the lyrics. Julie Brown is a goddess. I love Julie Brown. That is not the downtown variety. The original variety.
I like the downtown variety of Julie Brown as well.
Just fine.
Yeah. But Julie Brown had a different career.
The not downtown Julie Brown. Julie Brown, the comedian. It was unbelievably hilarious.
I still feel like, you know, because they have all these things like, hey, two of the cast members from Scrubs have their own podcasts together now, that kind of thing. I'm like, can Julie Brown and downtown Julie Brown get a podcast together?
Or can Julie Brown just be in the public eye? Can we celebrate that she's a wonderful person?
I saw a straight-to-TV Christmas movie with her not that long ago. So
with Julie Brown?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, which one?
Oh God, it's awful.
well, shoot.
No, it's dang. Hold on.
I don't even remember what.
Hold on. I can't leave everybody hanging like this. Hang on. I'm gonna pause this and I'll come back. All right, and we're back. The movie I was thinking of is called Christmas with the Andersons, which is seriously one of, if not the worst Christmas movie I've ever seen.
It's about
a family. Who lives like in a trailer and they've got nothing and they're total like, you know, deep South cliches. And then they give birth like in the middle of a car chase with the cops. And then it cuts to like 5 years later and they never explain it. But now they're rich and living in Beverly Hills and have different accents. And they've completely forgotten what it's like to not be rich and they become total assholes. And then Julie Brown is like their aunt or something who comes to live with them. And you think, oh, this is going to be about how like Julie Brown does like the Mary Poppins thing and turns her life around. No, she's just kind of there. Basically, everyone in the movie is a real asshole except for Julie Brown, and somehow everything turns out okay. It's awful. I could go on this movie forever.
We're off on a tangent on Julie Brown, but Julie Brown was tapping into this sort of widespread fantasy of essentially getting with a dumb guy.
Right. And this is a fantasy, and this is turnabout is fair play here, because there's so many fantasies that are very macho, very sexist fantasies have been perpetuated in media and largely in fiction of, you know, the ditzy, sexy girl various bikini movies and things.
Who is so unaware of herself that she'll show off her body and not be sort of aware of like how naked she is. I guess that's part of the appeal, I guess. And also, like, she's so unintelligent that she can kind of, I guess, be tricked into doing something sexual. I'm not exactly
sure what the appeal is. Gross. It's inherently gross.
It's unbelievably gross. I'm trying to figure out why it is such a trope. But yeah, this is a flip of that.
Yeah.
And we see these sort of like dumb hunk characters throughout media as well. They're not as common. But we recently talked about Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. There's a character like that in that movie. Trying to think of like other examples. Even in Paranorman, there's this sort of like hot hunky guy who's none too bright.
I think of Ken from the Barbie universe. Ken has always come across me, like, even in like Toy Story 3, he's not the brightest character in the story, is he? he's there to look good in those shirts. Mm. But anyway, Tarzan the Ape Man and Tarzan and His Mate, they are inherently, let's just use the word, problematic. Mm. They are deeply colonialist fantasies that often engage in direct racism. That there were more racist colonialist adventure fantasies at the time doesn't change that. Like, if you put Trader Horn and Tarzan, in either of these two Tarzan movies next to Trader Horn, the Tarzan movies will seem like, oh, thank God.
Yeah.
Because Trader Horn is so unbelievably racist.
They'll seem weirdly sensitive in comparison.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean they're not racist.
No, they're still incredibly racist.
No, but they were big hits. They had a big impact on the culture.
Edgar Rice Burroughs was a colonialist. He believed in that stuff. That's what John Carter is also about.
Exactly. Marina Sullivan's really good in these movies. I think Johnny Weissmuller is actually a pretty good Tarzan. And they look handsome. The swinging on vines is actually kind of funny because sometimes it looks really cool and other times it's very clearly a trapeze. Like, it's got like that handle and everything, but they just wrapped some leaves around it and it's like, yeah, I'll let you have it. Like, that's where you have to go because it's cool trapeze stuff. It's just not clearly a trapeze. But in any case, these two, and I haven't seen all the other ones, these two are still watchable. Again, there's definitely stuff you're going to have to get over if you want to enjoy them. Or you're going to have to just say, I don't enjoy this because this part's shitty or whatever. My point is that these two might actually be worth watching. The other ones are just mostly crap.
You've seen all of them. Some of them are borderline unwatchable.
Is there any of the sequels? Are there any of the sequels that's actually like, yes, again, at its heart, it is what it is, but like the production was good. Like,
no, and in fact, like if you watch a lot of the sequels to the Universal Monster classics, the ones that sort of stretched into the 40s and 50s, and they just got cheaper and cheaper and worse as you went.
And then some of the Mummy movies is like half an hour is just revisiting the previous Mummy movies.
Yeah, it's just like a lot of clips from the previous movie. Shameless. They're trying to get the same actors back to play the same roles, but like 20 years have passed and they look a lot older, and it's just not quite the same sense of fun. And that's the same thing that's going on with Tarzan. But Tarzan, because they kind of ran dry on ideas, starts going to some pretty kooky places. There's one where Tarzan does go to the big city. There's one
that
at least makes sense. Yeah. Tarzan does find a son, and they name the son Boy. The son is just named Boy.
And Jane doesn't have any better ideas than that?
No, it's just Boy. Call him Boy.
I love when she's like, should we give him like a name with some dignity? Like, no.
And golly, I hate Boy. Boy is such a terrible idea. It's just, he's like the Scrappy Doo of the Tarzan universe.
Yeah.
And then eventually Tarzan knows where there's a store of like hidden conquistador gold somewhere.
Okay.
Tarzan has a treasure, and then Tarzan eventually will end up fighting Nazis because they'll be made into the 40s, like, and Nazis invade Tarzan's
realm. At least he's got the right enemy in that one, you know? Like, that's who he should be fighting. Tarzan fights
like a secret tribe of Amazon warrior princesses in one of these movies.
That's kind of obvious.
Yeah. They're not good. They're just cheap 40s adventure movies that just aren't fun to watch anymore. All
right. Well, we're going to be watching next time on Episode Zero, a cheap 1960s horror movie that is fun to watch.
Absolutely, it is.
Actually, I'm taking your word on this because I haven't seen this one yet. But I'm very excited.
You'll love it.
We're going to be watching a William Castle horror film called Mr. Sardonicus. Great name. Whitney, give him the log line. Just pitch it a little bit.
Mr. Sardonicus is, it's about a guy in a mask, and he's, he's doing like experimental treatments and he's trying to correct his, like, something horrible that happened to his face. Mm. And the gimmick in this one was the punishment pole. That is, near the end of the movie, William Castle, the director, appeared on screen and said, okay, he's done a lot of really horrible things. Should he get away with it or should we punish him? And you got to hold up a big thumbs up or a thumbs down in the theater to decide the fate of Mr. Sardonic.
And we'll talk about this in detail, but the idea was they would run the ending based on what got the most votes. And it's one of William Castle was a pioneer in the world of audience participation. And we'll talk a lot about that on the next episode of Episode Zero. I'm very excited. William Castle is a really exciting filmmaker to discuss.
Yeah.
So thank you, everybody, for listening to Episode Zero. Of course, we're incredibly grateful to you for spending your time with us. We're especially grateful to all of our patrons. If you head over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, you'll get a bunch of exclusive shows and polls to help decide the content of future episodes of our podcasts at any tier. And we have a lot of shows. We have shows about Batman, Star Trek, Disney, commentary tracks. We just dropped a commentary track for the movie Howard the Duck. The Academy Awards. We actually have an episode in which we reviewed Trader Horn in full. And we also have one where we reviewed Chang, which we also mentioned on this episode. God, I hate that movie, Trader Horn. That's just a terrible motion picture on a variety of levels. But in any case, we talk about all those things. It's all fun, I hope. So thank you especially to all of our patrons. It's so late. Thank you especially to all of our patrons. If you want to talk to us on anything we discussed in this episode, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you want to talk about anything else, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And we might read your letter on an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail. Yeah. We also, if you can't afford to be a patron, of course, we encourage you to subscribe wherever you find us. Leave us a review. If you can't afford to be a patron and you want to help out, leaving a review helps immensely. It just really helps, you know, boost us up the recommendations and all of these things. So it helps us out. So thank you for everyone who's left a review, even if it was negative. Thank you. Thank you for your honesty. We're on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
We have a soap store. That's right, soap.
I don't. It's yours.
Well, okay. Well, me and my wife and partner, M. Lopez de Silva, we have a soap store over on Etsy. It's called Salt Cat Soap, all one word. We sell designer soaps. As of recording right now, all the soaps in the store were designed by M. Lopez de Silva, but I have one or two designs that are debuting this Saturday. However, if you want soap earlier, there is still a sale on some soaps on some soaps until I think April 2nd on some of our cooler soaps. We have a sale. So, but then new soaps debut on the first Saturday of every month. So check it out on Saturday. We'll post a link. We're on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I said this part already. I'm still at Whitney Seibold.
There's always so much to get through at the end. And until next time, I see you. Ever in anticipation.